Indeed.
Hello there. Today is Wednesday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, what's next for the U.S. when it comes to dealing with the threat of North Korea? An explosion in Brussels' central train station.
This incident is considered as a terrorist attack.
The U.S. Space Agency says it's discovered Earth-like planets. Also ahead, an Albanian singer who is taking the music scene by storm. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the United States is urging China to play a more prominent role in combating global terrorism and help change the calculus on North Korea ahead of high-level security talks with Beijing. Tensions between the U.S. and North Korea have been heightened by dozens of North Korean missile launches and two nuclear bomb tests since the beginning of last year. And now, in the light of the death of a young American who died days after returning home from North Korea after being held for nearly 18 months. White House spokesman Sean Spicer addressed the issue at Tuesday's briefing.
We will continue to apply economic and political pressure and try to continue to work with our allies. We've had, I think, positive movement on China over the past 5 months of this administration. And we'll continue to work with them and others to put the appropriate pressure on North Korea.
President Trump said Tuesday that North Korea's treatment of 22-year-old American college student Otto Warmbier was a total disgrace. Joining me now for more on what lies ahead with North Korea is David Feierstein, Senior Vice President at the East-West Institute. So what is next in terms of how the U.S. responds to this tragedy?
An unfathomable tragedy and absolutely heartbreaking, obviously, for the family and really for all Americans to see this happen to someone, a student who was overseas visiting a country en route to study abroad. And you just never dream something like this possibly occur. But in terms of what it means for the United States and dealing with North Korea, I think one thing that is clear is the brutality of North Korea now has a very human face associated with it, and it's the face of Otto Warmbier, a student who was so highly regarded by all his peers and teachers. And now what probably was an abstraction for many Americans is something that is absolutely real, and there's a real human story and human tragedy of the first order that is now associated with North Korea in the minds of so many Americans who have seen this story unfold in recent days. And I think that it creates a sense of heightened urgency with respect to North Korea that perhaps wasn't there before this horrific ending to the story of Otto Warmbier. And I think that we're seeing that play out in some of the messaging from the president, from the administration, and others across the country who are expressing extraordinary feelings of brokenheartedness, but also extraordinary anger toward the North Korean regime and what they did to this young man. I have a feeling this very, very sad and tragic episode is going to figure very prominently in the thinking of the administration in the United States as we deal with the much broader issues of North Korea and its pursuit of nuclear weapons.
And speaking of nuclear weapons, how far off are they from being able to create a nuclear missile capable of hitting the Pacific U.S.? It sounds like not that far off.
The analysis that I've heard, and you know, there are different people that look at this particular question and make assessments based on the best information available. And in terms of information that's in the public domain that I would have access to, my sense is that there's a broad consensus among American experts and I think others in the world that are tracking North Korea's efforts that we're probably within 2 to 4 years of that capability being there unless something specific is done to stop this forward motion that we're seeing in North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons. And so, I think we're looking at a problem that comes to a head within the next 2 to 4 years. Everyone's best guess is that this is a problem that this president in this term is going to have to deal with.
What can we do, though? It would seem that we don't have a lot of options without a lot of people potentially getting hurt. I know the president tweeted about China saying they did their best, basically, but what exactly does that mean?
With respect respect to the tweet, it's difficult to know for sure what that means because it's not apparent to anyone that's looking at North Korea-related developments that there was a very specific precursor to that tweet with respect to the particular issue of North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons.
And what about the chances of getting those last three Americans that are being held in North Korea out of there?
One thing I think we should note at the outset is that to the best of my recollection, I think this is the first instance in which an American has actually died as a result of treatment or non-medical treatment in North Korea. In other words, there have been any number of instances in which North Korea has apprehended Americans, held them for some period of time, months, or in a couple of cases, a year or more. But ultimately, they've tended to be let go, and they've tended to come back in more or less the same physical health that they entered North Korea in. This particular case of Otto Warmbier was obviously an extraordinary and heartbreaking exception to that. It raises the stakes greatly with respect to the notion of Americans being held in North Korea. My gut reading of this situation is that because Otto Warmbier's death was such a departure from past practice in terms of how this type of imprisonment scenario has unfolded, that this was probably something that North Korea didn't bank on. And I suspect this episode will probably result in North Korea looking at the other three situations in which Americans are being imprisoned and probably making efforts to make sure that this scenario doesn't play out again. Because obviously when you have someone leaving North Korea in the kind of shape that Otto Warmbier did, owing to the horrific treatment that he received in North Korea, that takes this whole thing to a very different level and actually ends up reducing whatever leverage that North Korea may feel it generates from imprisoning these Americans in the first place. So I suspect they're going to be looking very closely at how they treat these three remaining American prisoners. I don't know that this will necessarily expedite the release of those prisoners, but I suspect that it will focus the U.S. government even more intensively than it has been on gaining the release of those three Americans as soon as humanly possible. Because, of course, now in the mind of so many here in this country, and understandably, there's a much greater sense of risk associated with this type of imprisonment in North Korea. And I think that, again, that raises the stakes for all involved.
David Feierstein, Senior Vice President at the East-West Institute. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Republicans are getting ready for a Senate health care vote. The White House hosts Ukrainian president, saying Russian sanctions will remain in place. U.S. election officials and cybersecurity experts will testify on the Russian hacking. And a Russian plane comes within meters of a U.S. jet flying over the Baltic Sea. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Belgian troops shot dead a suspected suicide bomber in Brussels' central train station Tuesday, but there were no other casualties in what authorities are treating as the latest terrorist incident in Europe. Here's prosecutor Eric van der Sipt.
About 8:30, there has been an explosion in central station here in Brussels. The suspect has been neutralized by the military that were present at the scene immediately after the explosion.
The man was shot by one of the routine military patrols who had been active in Brussels since the attacks more than a year ago. They declined to comment on witness accounts that the man had shouted Islamist slogans first. In the Syria conflict, Australia says it's suspending airstrikes by its forces in Syria. This coming days after Syrian ally Russia threatened to target planes from the U.S.-led coalition operating in the area in response to the downing of a Syrian fighter jet by the U.S. Air Force Sunday. VOA's Ira Melman asks Nicholas Harris with the Center for New American Security just how serious this situation is.
The situation is serious in the sense that there is an atmosphere that could lead to escalation. The escalation between Russia and the United States at this stage is unlikely. However, we could continue to see increased attacks by the Assad regime and Assad's Iranian allies against local Syrian U.S. partner forces that are conducting the counter-ISIS campaign. And that would be a major development that could force the U.S. into a conflict with Iran and Iran-backed proxy forces.
Well, it's obvious, as you're alluding to, that this whole Syrian conflict, especially in the eastern Syrian desert, has become a proxy war. It has been for a while. Quite a few players vying for territory vacated by ISIS losses. The increased participation of Iran might have moved to the forefront now. How much of a concern is that?
Iran's role in Syria is a major point of concern for the Trump administration. And now that the counter-ISIS campaign is winding down in Iraq, as Iraqi security forces and local militia forces take that city finally from ISIS, Iranian-backed Iraqi Shia militias will begin to flow into Syria, support Bashar al-Assad's war effort. And they are going to turn their eye to eastern Syria, Syrian desert, the lower Euphrates River Valley, centered on ISIS's new capital, Deir al-Zor, near the Syrian-Iraqi border, and they want to get there first because they are worried, particularly the Iranians, that as the U.S.-led coalition continues to make gains and to seize and conquer territory from ISIS, that the U.S. will hold that territory in eastern Syria and, in fact, create an American military mandate that would prevent Assad from reclaiming all of his territory back and therefore begin a chain of events that could lead to the destabilization and potential collapse of Assad's regime.
Australia pulling out, at least temporarily, or suspending its airstrikes after the Syrian plane was shot down by U.S. jet. Is that a threat to the coalition at all?
It's a worrying concern, but the fact of the matter is that the U.S. has been conducting the bulk of airstrikes against ISIS, and the U.S. has really led the military effort to train up local Syrian partner forces against ISIS. Of course, if coalition partners decided to make a temporary suspension of operations into an indefinite suspension of operations into a permanent suspension of operations, that would be a concern. But I think at this point in time, there are major incentives for the United States and Russia to de-escalate their local Syrian partners. And this is a dynamic that we should be watching. Fundamentally, Syria is a geographic space now. There's no one unitary state from Damascus that controls all of Syria's territory. There are various zones of control. And Syria, in many ways, is like a monopoly board. And the more powerful local Syrian actors are trying to capture as much space on that board. And both the Russians and the Americans, as the most powerful outside actors from outside the region, who are actively supporting local Syrian partners, have incentives to keep this from becoming a wider war and a wider conflict. However, local Syrian actors, particularly the Assad regime, have an incentive to try to force a conflict between the United States and Russia, because that could frustrate any potential project to create American military mandate in Syria that would frustrate Assad's ability to reclaim all of his country again.
That's Nicholas Harris with the Center for New American Security. Now let's take a look at what's trending on social media today. Andrew Palcheski joins us. Hey, Andrew, what's the word today?
Today, social media has gotten a bunch of people arrested, and it's going to get a bunch of people a college degree. So we'll start with those arrests. Yesterday, we talked about how the U.S. Supreme Court asserted that people have a right to use social media, that it's part of free speech. It's important to remember that that does not guarantee necessarily what you can say on social media, and it's not a universal guarantee across the world. Case in point, authorities in Germany have arrested 36 people in connection with posts they made on social media where they made threats or incited violence or racist activity. As we've talked about before, hate speech continues to be an issue across Europe, not just in Germany, but France and the United Kingdom have been very outspoken about legislation to hold social media companies accountable. We've seen also EU-wide legislation to stop hate speech and hate video that they've passed that we've talked about before. Unclear if there are going to be more arrests or if this is just one kind of example that the German authorities are making, but it's part of a trend that we've been seeing when people incite violence, when they have extremist views on social media, those posts get shut down and people do get arrested.
Okay. But it's not all bad that comes out of social media, right?
No, it's good. In fact, you could actually get a degree majoring in becoming a viral social media star. And
wow.
That's what's happening at this Yiwu Industrial and Commercial College outside of Shanghai. It's teaching 33 students how to become the next viral social star. Things like photography, fashion and makeup, but also online marketing, public relations, and mobile and e-commerce strategy. And so that's where a lot of this lies, in that e-commerce. Because while this sounds silly, and you think, why would someone get an associate's degree in viral social media? There are over 700 million people in China who are online and on social media. And one of the big things there is e-commerce, virtual gifts that people give to their favorite social media stars. In fact, one of the top earning stars in China makes over $40 million just from being a viral star. So there is some money there, and it might not be a bad decision to go and try to become a viral star. Some people saying it's not that much different than taking maybe modeling classes or marketing classes or some form of business classes, albeit of a different variety. So we'll see if this makes its way over to the U.S., if we start seeing courses on this. Maybe not a college major per se, but we have seen in the past some colleges do have courses on unique things, and I wouldn't be surprised if this was one of them. Not necessarily just about being viral and getting a lot of fans, but the marketing behind it, the public relations behind it, the ways to actually film this stuff. Because when you think about it, social media does encompass all of that. And even these YouTube stars that are viral, they have to shoot their videos, edit them, promote them. So it does take a lot of work behind the allure of being a celebrity online.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APOW. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA. VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, NASA's Planet Hunting Telescope has found new planets outside of our solar system that are likely the right size and temperature to potentially have life on them, broadly hinting that we're probably not alone. After 4 years of searching, the Kepler telescope has detected a total of 49 planets just in the Goldilocks zone, and it only looked in a tiny part of the galaxy, 0.25% of a galaxy that holds about 200 billion stars. Outside scientists agree that this is a boost in the hope for life elsewhere. Joining me now to talk more about it is NASA Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador Greg Redfern. Hi, Greg. So what exactly did they find?
NASA just announced that they had uncovered, I believe it's 289 new exoplanets, of which 10 were found to be possibly places where life might be able to evolve because of the situation involving the presence of favorable conditions, including water and so forth.
What's an exoplanet?
An exoplanet is the technical term for planets that exist beyond our solar system and orbit other stars. We live in a time when we know of almost 4,000 other worlds in our Milky Way galaxy.
What are the chances that of all of them, there's human-like life there?
I mean, we can't really put a percentage or any kind of a figure on it because we don't know enough about these planets. Now, when NASA launches the James Webb Space Telescope in October of 2018, we will be able to check on some of these exoplanets with JWST and actually study the atmosphere. In studying the atmosphere, we'll be able to detect water vapor, we'll be able to detect methane, we'll be able to detect biological markers. So we can't see if there's life out there, but there's nothing that precludes life from being out there. We just haven't found it yet. Astronomers have calculated that based upon the number of exoplanets that are being discovered, that on average, maybe 10, major planets, like we have in our solar system. We have 8 major planets. We have hundreds of minor planets, which are being discovered. But each star in our Milky Way galaxy may have a minimum of 10 major planets orbiting it. And when you take the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, 200 to 300 billion, and you multiply that by 10, you're looking at 2 to 3 trillion planets possible in our Milky Way galaxy alone. To have life evolve, you need a couple things. One, you need a star that provides steady amount of energy and light at just the right amount. And guess what? You need a planet for life as we know it to evolve. And the last thing, you need a period of time. And of course, all of this is based upon our carbon-based life form. Who knows? We get into Star Trek type stuff, and there might be things out there. We have no idea how life evolved.
That's NASA Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador Greg Redfern. Thanks so much. Well, the restaurant business can cause some serious heartburn. It's a mixed salad of bureaucracy, money, and paperwork that keeps some chefs from ever even selling that first plate of food. But there may be hope, as restaurant incubators are offering chefs an alternative menu for success. Arash Arbasadi reports from Washington.
It's almost lunchtime at Chaya Farm to Taco, a restaurant in Washington.
We came out with this seasonal plant-based taco idea, and we weren't sure anybody was going to want it.
So Bettina Stern and her business partner tested their product at a local market.
In an hour and a half, we sold out of those 50 portions, and next week we came back with enough for 100, sold out of them in an hour and a half.
Eventually, she says, 50 tacos in May of 2013 became more than 30,000 tacos just this past April.
I don't think we would be here today if it wasn't for Union Kitchen.
Stern's secret ingredient, a food incubator called Union Kitchen.
We're basically here to give them the resources that they need.
Resources like insurance brokers, tax attorneys, and design companies.
By incubating our members, we're actually putting them more directly in touch with those resources.
70 fledgling businesses using professional kitchens built for chefs without restaurants.
What Union Kitchen does is it allows us to come in and just get started right away with pretty minimal capital.
So Nupta really Philip Vang owns Foodini, an online restaurant that works with refugee chefs like Majid. Trained to cook in Syria and living in a state of constant war, his parents told him to leave.
I fled to Jordan and started to see my city and my home in pictures on Facebook and on the internet. I saw my home in ruins. It hurts me to think about it now.
His birthplace destroyed, Majid's past is now present when he cooks.
Every day or every week, I'm introducing something new in my way, the Majid way.
Just the way his mom used to make. Now married with 2 kids of his own, Majid has an opportunity made possible by Union Kitchen, Foodini, and his new life far from the violence of war. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Oh, a new single has been released by a London-based singer whose family hails from Eastern Europe. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London tells International Edition's Sarah Williams all about it.
Our subject is a beautiful young Albanian singer who has grown up in London, but family heritage is from Kosovo and Albania. Her name is Dua Lipa. And people will know her probably easiest from the big hit that she had in the last year, Scared to Be Lonely, which is a song that was produced and created by Martin Garrix with Dua Lipa. But after a long 2-year wait, her debut self-titled album finally came out at the beginning of June, and she's got a new single, and we're going to listen to the new single from Dua Lipa right now called Lost in Your Light.
Over and over, waves are front.
Well, that's kind of an interesting background she's got, being Albanian but living in London.
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of singers who come from that part of the world. Rita Ora, however, has a history from Kosovo. But Dua Lipa's the new kid in town, although she's not really new. She's kind of released a whole bunch of music over the course of 2 years, which has been a long wait. And I know you're going to ask me why the wait, and my answer will be, I don't know. It's just taken that long. So she's released a number of singles from the album, but she said she feels great. She just can't believe that finally her album has been released. And so far, the music's been well received. She opened up at the BBC One big weekend concert that they just hosted there in London recently. And she's on a fast track to doing well. I mean, as I mentioned, Scared to Be Lonely made it to the top 10 on the Billboard charts. So now she's got the new song, and hopefully it will do just as well for her. And the new song features Miguel, who's another very popular singer. So Dua Lipa with Miguel's help and Lost in Your Light.
Is she touring?
As a matter of fact, she is. But she's not doing a headline tour yet, but she's kind of doing little performances along the way, a few festivals. A lot of the artists are doing festivals. It gives them a chance to try out some new material, see what the crowd's reaction will be. And then she is planning a full-blown tour now that her new album has finally been released.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdulrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since the mid-1990s, when limited self-rule was established in the West Bank and Gaza, the United States has contributed more than $5 billion in economic and non-lethal security assistance to the Palestinians. Under President Donald Trump, that assistance is slated to continue. The goal of such assistance is to help meet the humanitarian needs of the Palestinian people and foster the conditions of stability and prosperity that could lead to a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has made clear, the United States is looking for a change in the long-standing policy of the Palestinian Authority to make payments to the families of terrorists killed or wounded in carrying out violent attacks against Israelis. In testimony before Congress, Mr. Tillerson said both he and President Trump raised the issue with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas during their May visit to Bethlehem. Although the Palestinian Authority announced last month that it was stopping payments to some Hamas-affiliated prisoners, that move fails to address the scope of U.S. concerns over the practice of rewarding terrorists and murderers, which has continued. As President Trump said, standing in Bethlehem next to President Abbas, "Peace can never take root in an environment where violence is tolerated, funded, or rewarded. We must be resolute in condemning such acts in a single, unified voice."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.